Well, I'm going to talk to you about the problem associated with self-driving cars, because this is a subject that is very topical. Everyone is talking about it. And in the last 100 years, we have moved really from horse-drawn carriages to these self-driving cars, automated machines, where originally robots were fabricating those machines. Today they are driving them. So there is a trend, an accelerated trend towards innovation in that particular field. The most pressing issues will be to deal with driverless vehicles that are fully autonomous. We're not there yet, but we're moving in that direction. As you know, Google, Tesla, Ford, Audi, Nissan, and Mercedes-Benz, and many others, automakers and technology companies, are racing to reach the top level of automation, which is top level is level 5, where the automated system can perform all driving tasks that a human driver could perform under all conditions. So at the present, therefore, we're not yet there. We're in a sort of a gray area between computer-driven and also human-driven cars. The autonomous driving raises technical issues, legal issues, and ethical issues. I shall very briefly look at the technical issues and then concentrate mostly on ethical and legal issues, which must be addressed as soon as possible. And in the last, in the last 10 years, really, this has gone from science fiction to an emerging reality, which must be translated into reality. Now, first of all, the definition. What is an autonomous car? An autonomous car is characterized as having the capabilities of sensing, planning, and acting without the assistance of any humans. The California, which has legiferated on autonomous cars, defines them as follows. A vehicle equipped with technology that has the capability of operating or driving the vehicle without the active physical control or monitoring of a natural person. Now, the technical issues involved for fully automated vehicles are quite different whether you are looking at the situation today and what it will be tomorrow. For instance, today, as you know, so far, you have different types of, you have steering assist, you have cars with self-parking and other cars which deal with lane departure warning. So this is in the cars that you can buy today. They are not really yet any fully automated cars on the market, although there have been several produced by by big companies which are just testing the ability to do so. So the driver will provide only the destination or navigation input, and then the rest will be done by algorithm with an artificial intelligence. And so this is a technology which requires some legal parameters to control it. Now, an autonomous vehicle will employ various methods, sense, plan, act, design of robotics, a series of sensors, cameras on the vehicle in relation to the environment. It relies also on global positioning. It relies on the radar and various other methods try to deal with what they will encounter on the road, the speed, lane changing, and so on. And with all this information that is collected, all the data collected by these various sensors, is then transformed, converted into commands to the vehicle control system, steering, the throttle, the brakes, and so on. Now, challenges are still present, particularly with respect to pedestrian traffic infrastructure, tunnels. What happens if you go into a tunnel with a driverless car? What about overpasses and the weather? The weather is a big problem, particularly if you have snow on the roads and the marking on the roads no longer are visible. And also cyber attacks. So some people might be surprised, but there have been cyber attacks on your own computers. Well, they could also attack the computers and the software, well, the software that is in a car. And then what happens, you know? So you have these security risks. Computer viruses could also be inserted in the software inside the car. So, and then what happens if there is a failure in the software itself? It may well be that suddenly one of the transistors no longer works, and then what's the car going to do? Will it stop immediately, or will it still do something which will result into an accident? Also, electrical features that are in the automated car present some problems. Now, why are autonomous cars considered beneficial for society, institutions, manufacturers, and the public? What are the pros and cons? Here, there is a list that you can see of the benefits of an autonomous car. I shall not go over each one of them because I don't want to take your time, plus we're a little bit pressed. But I will just indicate a few things that to me are important, and many people haven't thought about it. First of all, well, improved safety, of course, reducing accident is the major advantage of automated cars. Now, what does it do? Well, it allows more time for focusing on work and consuming media. And for instance, you will be able to read the paper, to listen to the TV, to phone, to text. This raises the issue of design. How is the car going to be designed? And here, there has been a whole discussion about the inside of these automated cars. And there are three things that are important. Three big changes. First of all, what can you do inside a vehicle when you are not behind the wheel? What is the inside look? For instance, in the Volvo Concept 26, the seat can recline completely and you can sleep there in the car. In the Ford, the new Ford, the car screen will be covered by a windshield, by an opaque thing, so again you can sleep without being bothered by the light. And in other cars, particularly the Mercedes, they're envisaging something really quite extraordinary, where on the side of the interior you're going to have pictures of mountains or lakes or whatever, and you will have also the scent. For instance, if you have a forest, you can smell and music that goes with it. So now, from the point of view of safety, since their accidents will be reduced by 90%, there is no need to have a car that is solid like a tank and which crumples when there is an accident. Full of airbags too. None of this is necessary anymore, since you can reduce the rate of accident, as I said, to over 90%. So what are you going to have? You're going to have more glass, more plywood, and lightweight manufactured, lightweight materials. And this will have an influence on the use of power, because it will make the car much lighter, and consequently it will use less gas or electricity once these cars use electricity as a method of transportation. And finally, also is important the branding. The interior will be the main difference between the car makers, because not everyone will want to do the same cars. So in order to make it attractive, you're going to maybe Ford will do take a special approach to the interior, others will take a different approach. So the difference between the car makers and the competition of the material and the quality of the material. In fact, I have read that somewhere, I don't know if it's Ford, but they're planning to have a gym inside of the car so that people can just relax and do some exercise. So. But all this, you see, is going to be done not immediately. The series of improvement will take place over time, just like dog breeding, for instance, where little by little you get to the. Other things that are important is the less stress and road rage. Since people are going to relax and do sports or whatever in the car, they won't be able to get mad if the traffic takes too much time. Now, one thing which is a really good advantage is the improved mobility for older or impaired persons. People like me, who have to take the test every 2 years because I'm over 80, I won't have to do that anymore because I won't be driving and I can relax. But a lot of people who are, in addition, who are handicapped will be able, instead of taking a taxi or something else, they will be able to enjoy going for a drive. So. Now, the negative impact those are the benefits, but the negative impacts are job losses. There's no doubt that taxi and truck drivers and the car industry may be affected. Also the insurance companies, because since there will be no accidents or very little accident, you're not going to be to have to insure people paying a high premium. Being driverless, at the present, when you get an insurance, they're going to look at your driving record, they're going to see if you've had an accident, if you've had a ticket, and so on, and then the premium is going to be based on that. Well, when you have a driverless car, you're no longer, so you have to revise the insurance. From a legal point of view, you'd have to revise the insurance policy to take this into consideration. So there was. Now, hacking and cyber attack, I've already mentioned, is something that is a negative aspect. But one thing that a lot of people did not consider is what happens when they are both old and driverless car on the same road. This is one thing which people haven't considered, because the driving will be different, the people are different. And you can have an old jalopy there sharing the road with a brand new automated car. Yes.
There I would pull from a lot of Tesla's new anecdotes. So Tesla, they now have their own self-driving systems on their cars. You're only supposed to actually use it on a highway, but the amount of lives that Tesla's self-driving systems has saved at this point is just ridiculous. These self-driving cars, they just know what's going to happen before it even happens.
They exchange with.
Well,
if
no,
you have
not,
several.
They're not exchanging information. They're just analyzing the situation within their immediate area, and they can calculate based on how fast the car is going, how fast it would need to, or how quickly it would need to stop, how much distance it would need. There's no communication
but
going on.
But there's communication with other cars on the same highway, but there's also the question, they have to observe, the car has to observe the speed limit. Take the 401, for instance, going to Montreal, everyone is going over the speed limit. Now, automated cars will have to observe the 100 kilometers, and this is going to slow down everything and even be a cause of accident. Like in Quebec, where you have in some of the highways, you have you cannot go below a certain speed or above a certain speed.
Yeah, but that assumes that some people are driving autonomous cars and other people are not. Right?
Or even if they were only automated cars, because now, granted that it will reduce accident, but it'll take much longer to go from Toronto to Montreal if you follow all the regulations with respect to the Highway Act. Now I would like to say something about ethical issues. Slide 17. Now this is quite important because it has been a big issue. Should driverless vehicle contain ethical and moral principles in algorithm contained in their software in order to engage in moral judgment and make difficult decisions with which other types of artificial intelligence machine are not required to make, you see. What would happen is the choice between two potentially life-threatening situations. Should the vehicle be able to make those decisions? This is illustrated by, some of you who are philosophers will know that, the trolley paradox, which means that do you deviate the car and kill one person or stay on course and kill five? That's the example given to those who discuss the... Now, in reality, this may be different, but you have a choice. Let's say that the car is driving there, and suddenly at a red light, another person is going right through the red light. So do you stop or do you hit the other car and get into an accident? Or suddenly a child steps from the sidewalk, steps in front of the car. Are you going to go right through the child or deviate and go into the other lane? But there's another car coming in the other lane and it's going to collide with you. And so your passengers are going to be killed. And you have avoided killing that child. Well, this has been debated at great length, there are two ethical theories that deal with the trolley paradox. In the trolley paradox, it's a trolley, a tramway that changes lanes, tracks. One is based on the what is called deontology ethics. And that means that you follow the order strictly, so that you would follow your program to go on this particular road to a particular place, and so you would go right through it and just hit whatever it is. The other one is the utilitarian approach of ethics, and here the decision is based on whether or not the decision that you make benefits the majority. And so in this particular case, you will, instead of killing five people, you're going to take the other option and you're just going to kill one person, theoretically, but it explains the system. Now, how would you program the algorithm? You are the programmer, and how are you going to program these situations, these choices between two potentially life-threatening situations? Now, some have suggested that you would also always program it on an utilitarian basis so that the decision would be made by the, would be in the logarithm, and then the software would tell you what to do in that sense. The other approach is that, you should stop the car, but that may not be possible, especially if you're going at a reasonable fast speed. But another approach was taken, which is that you should look at the moral preferences of the owner of the car. And then that would indicate how the logarithm should be programmed, what should be the logarithm and program in the software. So that in this particular case, it's pretty dangerous because you may have someone who may be quite aggressive, and I don't think it's a good one. I think that the decision should be a mixture of the two approaches, personally. Did you have a question, Mark?
Me?
No,
I was going to say that you could program the car so that it would anticipate that if there's a child there, that the child is going to come out, so it slows down, and it forces the car behind to slow down.
But you may not be, if it happens suddenly, you may not be able to slow down.
I stopped on a dime one time on the Don Valley Parkway. I stood up, I had both feet on the brakes when I stood up.
Not on the 401.
No. Because the person in front of me stopped. Their car stopped. And we had been going at full speed. And I was just at the right length behind. I wasn't too close, but I wasn't very far either.
What if there's ice on the road?
Yes. So on both of your examples, if you speak to the police who've seen lots of carnage on the highways, they'll tell you there's no such thing as an accident. They'll tell you that you've been driving at the wrong speed or doing the wrong things for the conditions. So if you're in a place, first of all, where there's likely to be a child step out, you're probably in a neighborhood. In a neighborhood, now we've reduced the speed limit to 30. So the cars, if the cars are truly going to be able to do all the things drivers, so if I see a set of feet underneath a car in the distance, I know there's a chance they might step out. If I see a ball come across you, I'm going to get really slow. You can program these vehicles to that. I think this kill one or kill five is sort of not where it's at. It's like if it's driving for the conditions, then we're probably not going to have a lot of decisions like that.
Automation is, I guess, is not going to end unpredictability of life. There will always be things that we cannot control. So problems will happen. The question I think really is interesting is that what is the new ethics that we're going to put behind this? Because when a human being makes the wrong decision, well, the human being has to answer for it. We have a set of rules for that. We don't have them for a machine.
Well, I had an example, a personal example with my son was a small child, and I drove him to a hockey practice in the morning, and a big deer just crossed in front of the car. Now, I had a choice, either trying to avoid it and going to the ditch and roll over, or going right through. I just went right through and hit the deer, which actually escaped somewhere in the field. He didn't even get killed, but you have to face, and to answer your point there, also the other situation is that since it's a driverless car, the police cannot do anything because unless the law, the Highway Traffic Act is changed, you know, it would be the owner of the car, I suppose, or the user, but you couldn't charge anyone, maybe the manufacturer or the, I was going to deal with that in the legal aspect, or the or the programmer. How are you going to determine that? And secondly, with respect to some criminal offenses, if you find them in the criminal code or you find them also in the Highway Traffic Act, you need to have a mens rea, that the intent to harm. Now, how are you going to determine that? Who has the, obviously the manufacturer, the programmer didn't have the intent to harm anyone when they programmed the car. So you have a lot of issues that are arising in this. The other question that I wanted to raise was the legal aspects. since we're in the legal field, I won't mention anymore the criminal law, but question arises with respect to the civil liability, you see. Who is financially responsible for the damage that are caused by an automated vehicle? And here you have two possibilities. I'm not going to go into the detail of the law because first we don't have time, and secondly, I just mentioned the possibility. First is product liability. If the damage caused by the vehicle, the automated vehicle, is caused because of a defect in the program, then you have what is called product liability. You see, you would, the person responsible would be the manufacturer of the automated car, and because they would have to pay because it was a defect that was caused by it. Now, in turn, the manufacturer may turn against the programmer, or if it's a part that is defective, the manufacturer of the part that is defective. The other type of liability would be what is called a tort liability, which is based on the fault of someone, the fault of the owner or the user. That would be, for instance, the case where the system fails because you haven't kept it update. You see, you're supposed to keep even an automated car, you have to keep it in good condition, you have to update the software because things are changing. Maybe they're building a new bridge or something different, and the original software is not aware that this exists, or some potholes or whatever. In this particular situation, it's really rare that you're going to have someone who is responsible, because there is no driver, so you would have to turn against the user, but the user is doing nothing, he's just in the car, he doesn't drive. And also the other thing is that again, who are you going to turn against to recover? Well, in Sweden, you see, traffic insurance is based on damage, not liability. So it doesn't matter who is liable, as long as the damage is caused by an automobile, even today, outside the automated cars, recovery shifted to the insurer, and will covering, once you have automated cars, the insurer will cover not individuals, but technical failures, or anything that causes damage by the vehicle. Now, of course, it eliminates a lot, because since there are very few accidents, most of the litigation that takes place today and most of the insurance claims have to do with people who are injured, and that could amount to millions of dollars, particularly if you injure a child who is then disabled, and for a number of years you'll have to pay for this raises quite a few problems, but not as much. So there is an improvement there with automated cars because of the lack of accident that will cause injuries. And consequently, the premium of the insurance company will be lower, because you're no longer, as I mentioned I think earlier, you're no longer looking at the record, the driving record of the user of the car. I want to say a few words also about transportation as a service. On-demand transportation services by Uber. You see, autonomous cars in the future may be owned and operated in fleet by Uber and other companies. Now, Uber doesn't own the car. Uber just puts you in contact with individuals who own a car and are going to drive you. But car manufacturer might do the same thing, both of them would be self-insured, just like some airlines, personal motor insurance would be out of luck. Now, there are certain industries that are going to suffer as a result of that. First of all, the insurance business will be affected. Also, lawyers will be affected by this. But with Uber and other fleets of car ownership also will decline by 80 to 90% and end in big cities. But why own a car if you live in the city when you have like Uber fleet of cars that come and pick you up and so on? And one of the advantages is that the enormous amount of space devoted to parking could be used for housings and parks, so that you can eliminate all these ugly buildings. In the field of trucking already, there have been automated trucks that have crossed the United States without any accident. Now, a few more words, regulations. The U.S. on September 22, 2016 has announced guidelines for driverless cars and 15 standards for the design and development of autonomous vehicles and their safety are listed, like data sharing, privacy, vehicle cybersecurity, and so on. And Ontario, beginning January 1st, 2016, has launched a new pilot to allow for the testing of automated vehicle in Ontario road, on Ontario roads. And it's restricted for testing purposes, and it will run for 10 years, so they don't envisage more than the immediate. And if some of you are interested, it's Ontario Regulation 306-15. To conclude, many issues will have to be solved before driverless vehicle will take full control on the transportation of person and goods on land. So changes to level five will not come tomorrow. It will take some time. So they expect really not before 2025, 2030, before you will have fully automated vehicle on the road. Personally, I must say I'm a little bit dubious. I don't know if I would want to be. But I suppose we get used to everything. So,
Actually, I have a great quote for that. So, I know a lot of people, they look at a lot of technologies, especially driverless cars, and they're kind of scared of it. But the reality is, technologies, when they're new, they're always scary, and it's always the generation after that that accepts them. Mm. The quote comes from Steven Johnson in a book called Everything Bad is Good for You. It's just about how like pop culture actually makes people smarter. Funny argument, really. But the quote is, everything that exists when you're born is part of the natural world, and it exists. So like telephones, the television, trains, part of the natural world. So we accept them. Anything that's invented until the age of 30 is like the greatest innovation that could ever happen to mankind, and it only makes things better. Any innovation that happens after the age of 30 is against the nature of the entire planet and must be destroyed and ended right away. But like he points out, like when the telephone was first invented, people were terrified of it. When the trains first started showing up, they were terrified of those. And same thing, there's so much gap against the internet and smartphones, for example. And a lot of people, at least in my generation, we felt that's extremely misplaced. And it's just a juvenile.
Juvenoya.
I love that term. That's my favorite term. I also love the guy who coined it. His name's David Finkelhor. It's a great name to say.
The new lingo for cars is the third space. The home, the office, and the car. The car will be number one.
So that's actually a good segue. I'm going to have to cut things a little bit short here because we got to go. I don't want to keep you guys too long, but talk about spaces. I sort of wanted to just chat a little bit about geographies of the future, right? So we've been chatting about sort of like a little bit more micro trends, and I wanted to sort of look at the bigger picture and sort of ask this question of what our kind of world will look like from a geographical perspective moving forward. and what it sort of will take to compete and succeed in industries of the future, and what of today's cities are positioned for success. So what we're actually finding that we're really starting to see is that in the sort of industries of the future, a lot of things are really hinging upon domain expertise, right? So we're actually seeing almost a division of the world to a certain degree into sort of hubs of innovation clustered around a particular domain expertise. So when you actually look at this, you know, you can look at industries of the future, like, for example, genomics. We actually talked about that last class, where, you know, genomics is really clustered around universities. So, you know, you look at cities like Boston, you look at cities like Silicon Valley, so Stanford University, UCalifornia, Berkeley, where this type of research is going on. You look at cybersecurity, where, you know, these types of industries are clustered around cities where government and domain expertise can be built around security, right? So these are cities like Washington, Tel Aviv, London as well, and Moscow. And then you also have robotics as another industry of the future, which is typically clustered in cities where there's domain expertise surrounding industrial development and whatnot. So these are cities like Japan, South Korea, Germany. And then also in fintech, so financial technology, you're typically clustered around cities where there's a lot of economic activity, financial activity. So these are cities like New York, cities like London, cities like Ireland. And then you look at sort of internet businesses and things like that. Obviously, we know Silicon Valley. So I wanted to pose the question to you guys. What do you think Toronto could be known as in terms of domain expertise moving forward in the future? What do we think?
Gridlock.
Gridlock. What do you think?
So we have one of the most ethnically diverse cultures in the world here, which I think a lot of us are proud of. And as a result of that, we have the capacity to service a broad global community. So I think one of the strengths of the city, and certainly you see that reflected, is that we can go out in the world and be like the hub or the center for services. Right? Mm-hmm. We have a very big service industry. Mm-hmm. But not service like in our domestic market, but in a global market.
Right. Yep.
I've heard of wearables, like neuro wearables.
Okay.
Brain wearables.
In Toronto specifically?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Right. Starting to, you know, develop a bit of a culture around that, maybe a few companies. Okay.
We've always been the mining capital. We've been the mining capital of the world since the...
Right.
So
technology is an advanced sort of extraction and things like that, right? Okay. So I was wondering where you guys think Toronto lies in terms of... So there's been a ranking that's been done, you know, looking at different cities around the world in terms of how innovative they actually are. Where do you think Toronto ranks? Top 10, top 20, top 50, top 100? What do you guys think?
How many are there?
Let's say 100. Yeah? What do you think?
Well, in regards to immigration,
okay,
having people from so many different countries without being in trouble, I think Toronto's number one, because we have so many people from different countries without having the problems that the U.S. has.
Yeah, absolutely.
And other many other countries.
Yeah, no, I think that's
huge.
Absolutely right.
They look at Toronto, they look at Toronto,
yeah.
How did they do it?
I'm definitely going to touch on that a little bit just in the last... Yeah, one other thing? Another hand?
That was you.
I was just going to say that because Toronto is a hub city, and is so multicultural that we could have the potential for communication technology here.
Yeah.
Translation technology, instant translation technology,
right,
which you're already starting to see in earpieces like Battlefish.
Right.
This could be the level ground that everybody's come to.
Right. So in fact,
you have the rank there. This gentleman.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say fintech is ranking just deep on Toronto. I think it's really.
It's growing really rapidly. Yep. Absolutely.
As far as bridging Silicon Valley as a concept and fintech,
mm-hmm,
kind of seeing on the newswire they're kind of going into Silicon Valley in India, Silicon Valley in type of concept, especially in Israel.
Okay.
That's extremely moving.
Yeah, absolutely.
Data security.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to put this up just to sort of get us to think about, you know, Toronto as this incredible innovation hub, right? I mean, we're ranked right now 17th. This is a 2015 study that really looked at a variety of things, right? So this is looking at, based on the quality of talent, the pool for venture capital, resources, the experience and mentorship provided. to people, by to startup founders, and then looking at sort of the market reach of companies and also the ultimate performance and exit value of companies as well. So Toronto, as you can see, I mean, we're moving up. We're sort of amongst the ranks of some pretty impressive cities here. And, you know, as well, I think it's interesting to remember, and I wanted to sort of just talk about, I know we've got to speed things up here a little bit. There's a few things I want to chat about, but more importantly, you know, if we look at Toronto as, you know, a city that's moving up the ranks in terms of an innovation hub, and we look at just cities by and large, that they've always been incubators of growth. They've always, you know, been able to be places where people congregate in order to innovate because they really produce positive externalities, right? So ideas can be exchanged with low friction. People can come into contact with one another who have different ideas. Capital can flow rapidly. Talent can be more effectively coordinated and organized. And so, you know, the question is how do you build this, right? How is it that Toronto can move up the ranks as an innovation hub? And so, you know, we talk a lot about things like infrastructure, and we talk about, you know, using data better and investing in things like infrastructure. But in fact, what all of these cities, you know, that I showed here actually actually have in common is that you actually find that the most innovative on this list are the most open. And I think it's really interesting. You know, you hinted that earlier. I think there was somebody else that mentioned that as well. That, in fact, what really sort of brings these cities all together and what really sort of allows them to move forward and be well-positioned in order to succeed and thrive in the sort of more modern economy is really this kind of concept of openness, right? Where, you know, on an economic, you know, from an economic perspective, you know, getting rid of friction that costs time and money to get business done, but also political openness. So, you know, this is really sort of a higher level of efficiency where everyone in society can really gather, meet, work without friction, censure, and discrimination, right? So in order to sort of move forward and kind of, you know, look at this concept of openness as a sort of a competitive advantage, right, and a spirit that is not only going to filter down from the top to bottom, but filter from the top up, right? We talked about how in this new world, lifelong learning is becoming what is the essential ingredient for employees, for businesses to be able to foster and to be able to work at. And so really what's interesting is that, you know, if we look at what's going on, you know, in the political system and sort of the popular discourse, you're seeing almost a movement towards, you know, openness versus control, right? So what I'm sort of finding and what we've sort of seen through the research and a lot of the things that we've looked at here is that in the 20th century, the sort of fault lines dividing the world were very much between capitalism and communism, right? And in the 21st century, what we've sort of finding is that the debate and the discussion that's going to sort of define success versus, you know, difficulty in this new world is really the debate between openness and closeness, right? So this is really something, this binary is really something that is going to kind of define the success that governments are going to have, the success that employers are going to have, universities, and also ourselves, right? So are we open-minded and curious to learn the things we don't know? And really, do we have the humility to admit what we don't know and the open-mindedness to kind of figure it out, right? And that's sort of what I want to leave you with, you know, in terms of, you know, this idea of lifelong learning and how that will be fostered is that's really what it is. It's this defining line between openness and closeness. Like that's really going to what is really what's going to propel individuals forward in the new world rather than hold them back in terms of taking on new skills and fostering these kind of innovation hubs, as I mentioned, in these cities that are growing and having success versus cities that are growing, or sorry, not growing and not having success. Thank you.
In another group, they talk about the natural evolution of humans because that is in correlation mm-hmm. with this.
Yep.
Do you have any studies, any data on the natural population of humanity, because mm-hmm. that's
going to
be very much affected.
So the the natural evolution of humanity. So what does that mean?
That our brain, for example,
okay.
as time goes by, is changing.
Right.
We are changing.
Yeah.
And there
okay.
are so many people doing incredible mm-hmm. things physically, mentally.
Yeah. Right.
In
so brain capacity and whatnot.
India,
okay.
In the studies about people developing the third eye,
right.
testimonials and everything.
So almost as if the human brain can evolve. Is that
it
what you
is
mean?
Already evolved.
Right.
But is anybody putting all this together?
Yeah, actually. So it's funny you ask that because in a final lecture series, what I'm actually going to talk about is how in the new world, the brain is actually being rewired, right? And the different ways that it's being rewired and how technology is actually having a major impact on how we actually think and feel, right? How our emotions are being impacted by technology. So come next time, we're going to be talking about this quite a lot, actually.
Mesdames et messieurs, merci beaucoup. J'aimerais bien finir. J'aimerais bien remercier surtout Mathieu et puis Monsieur Castel. Thank you so much for the experts for leading this really wonderful dynamic discussion. I just want to remind you, the third and final session is on February 27th. So, this is to mention, and those of you who get the date or the day right wrong, next week we don't have a class, we don't have session. So a week after that, Monday, February 27th, is the final session. So please come on time, and we'll start early, and we'll finish on time as well. Thank you.
Thank you.